Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Egan. Brian Scurry is someone who chooses to be face-to-face with sharks, stingrays, and whales. It's something he's been doing for more than 30 years as a marine wildlife photographer. For 15 of those years, you've been seeing his incredible photography in National Geographic magazine. His cover story for the May issue is a focus on dolphin cognition. It's the result of 2 years of field work in 9 locations around the world. Scurry is also the explorer in residence at the New England Aquarium, where he'll be giving a lecture tonight at 7 on his life and work undersea. And to see some of his incredible photography, if you don't know it already, you can go to WGBHnews.org. Brian, it's really a pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's great to be here, Jim. And Marjorie, thanks.
Okay, so before we get to the state of the ocean, which is probably not very good, and going face-to-face with these sharks and the squid, apparently, I want to ask you about the photographs that we're talking about now, this dolphin cognition. And they are online, as Jim just said. These unbelievably clear photographs you've gotten of these dozens of dolphins like swimming together. Tell us about some of these pictures.
Right. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is I spend a lot of time in the ocean to make these images. On a normal story these days for National Geographic, I might be in the field for about 16 weeks. I try to divide that up over multiple trips to see different behaviors or different locations, different animals, times a year. And, you know, with a normal story these days, shooting digitally, I might shoot 60 or 70,000 pictures. So you're not seeing the bad ones. You're seeing those very special moments when everything sort of comes together.
Sounds like my younger kid on vacation, by the way, 60 or 70. So what does it mean? What is the thing? What are you evidencing?
Dolphin cognition.
Yeah. Cognition, yeah, right. So what we wanted to look at with this story was, you know, how smart are dolphins? Or as some of the researchers I was working with actually framed it better, how do we know dolphins are smart? We know that these animals have the second or the biggest brains relative to body size in the animal kingdom, second to humans. But we really don't know that much about how they're using these big brains in the ocean. We know they're highly complex societies. We know that they can use tools. We know that they communicate. You know, for lack of a better analogy, they have a language. But the truth is, because they're in the ocean and we don't see them that often, we don't get to really know that much about them. So this story sort of looked at some of the ways we know dolphins are smart.
Wait a minute. What kind of tools are they using?
Well, believe it or not, they actually, in Australia, they've been identified to pick up sponges and put them on their rostrum, on their nose, to ferret out prey on the bottom. I actually saw a dolphin in captivity, believe it or not, in Key Largo, picking up a blade of grass and sticking it through the fence so that little fish would come over, using it like a fishing lure to attract wild fish outside the fence to come in so he could eat them. I mean, they're very smart.
We're talking to Brian Scurry, and again, you know his photographs, and you can go to WGBHnews.org and check him out. You're a New England kid, right?
I am, yeah. Born and raised in Massachusetts,
so
still live there.
So is that what made you? I mean, you're an ocean guy.
Absolutely.
I've read you, but was it to be a photographer? Was it to be a scientist? I mean, what was the thinking in little Brian Scurry's head?
Well, in little Brian Scurry's head, he wanted to be an explorer. You know, from the earliest memories I have, my parents taking me to the beaches in Cape Cod or Rhode Island, I remember being fascinated by the ocean. So I started scuba diving when I was about 14 or 15 years old, and I then, within a year, attended a diving conference in Boston, the oldest dive show in the world, still going on. They just celebrated their 61st anniversary, the Boston Sea Rover Show. And as a teenager, sitting in the audience watching documentary filmmakers and photographers present their work, I had sort of an epiphany where I said this was the perfect marriage. I could be an explorer of the sea, but do it with a camera. So my goal was to work for National Geographic, but that was a rather lofty dream. You know, there's only two or three guys that had ever at one time been working there. And this little kid from a blue-collar town in Massachusetts had probably a 1 in a billion chance. But dreams do come true.
You know, when I'm looking at you, this is typical for me. You look like a normal person, I should say.
Well,
I read about some of the circumstances you have found yourself in, and you have a smile on your face. And again, I mean, describe for people who don't know your bio, your history, a couple of the situations you encountered where you were this close to not being around anymore.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, over the years, I've estimated that I've spent probably more than 10,000 hours underwater. And there have been certainly a handful of these dicey moments. I used to do a lot of shipwreck diving. I have a dozen dives on the Andrea Doria and deep German U-boats and so forth. And those were some of the most frightening things, because when you're down 250 feet in the North Atlantic crawling around inside a shipwreck, you know, it can be pretty dicey. But I've had other things. You know, I've sort of been lost for a few moments under polar ice, not being able to find my exit hole. And actually,
how can you say that, like, as a matter of fact
thing,
Brian?
How did you find it?
Well, I found another hole, actually. The hole that I had come through, I was photographing harp seals in the Gulf of St. Lawrence under 25-foot thick ice. And you go in the water through these leads, through these cracks in the ice, but they're always moving and shifting with wind and tide. So I had a guy whose job it was to keep an eye on me and the hole, but, you know, that hole closed up, so we had to find another way out.
Wait a minute. So do you just swim around underwater looking for holes?
Well, in theory, we would be able to enter and exit the same hole, and many times that was the case. But sometimes that's not possible. But because it's always moving and shifting, there are other cracks and other ways to get out. I mean, it's
so
not a good plan, but I mean, it does work.
How long did it take you in that situation?
It was just literally a couple of moments, a couple of minutes, but it seems like an hour. You know, your heart's racing. And
the reason you got lost in the Andrea Doria was because
that was just very briefly, but I had gone down into the second class dining room area to photograph a new closet that friends of mine had discovered filled with dishes, you know, these second class, beautiful Italian painted china. And I made some pictures and then, you know, had to come back out. And I was swimming around a staircase and down a sort of a corridor. And for a moment, you know, you're not sure where you're going. It's all silted out. It's monochromatic. You can't really see very well. And you don't have a lot of time. So, you know, but again, I don't want to overemphasize it. It wasn't that bad.
Okay, well, let's get to this picture that is famous that I've seen before. This is your assistant, I assume, that's with you.
That's a marine biologist.
Okay, marine biologist, who is, you know, right in front of this shark that looks to be a big shark.
Right.
A very big shark. And swimming right toward the assistant, you know, most of us would be like in total Jaws, you know, hysteria.
Yeah.
But he seems to be very calm.
Well,
he shark is. Looks pretty calm.
Yeah. And you know, sharks are a favorite subject of mine. I absolutely love photographing sharks. In fact, right now I am working on 4 brand new shark stories for National Geographic that will be published consecutively next year in 2016. And a big reason why I want to do shark photography is to sort of dispel these myths. I mean, they are predators. They are potentially dangerous animals, but they're far more villainized than they really need to be. And the truth of the matter is, today on planet Earth, we're killing in excess of 100 million sharks every single year. And we need predators to keep an ecosystem healthy. And when you consider that every other breath that a human being takes comes from the ocean, the oxygen we breathe, you know, we need sharks. So a lot of my work is to respect these animals, to show them for what they are, but also to show that they have a great value.
Who's killing them?
Well, it's fishing fleets around the world. In many cases, it's for the shark fins, you know, for the shark fin soup in Asia, Hong Kong, places like that. There's been some good positive traction to sort of reduce that, but it's still a very serious problem.
Do you is there like a little bit of a shark whisperer in you? When I've read some of the things about your relationship to sharks, and I know, and some other creatures that you've done just brilliant work with, do you feel like you can communicate with them? Is there a piece of you that has,
you know,
that in you?
I wouldn't go that far, Jim. I wouldn't say that I feel that I can communicate with them. I do feel that, you know, on any given day, a diver can have a wonderful experience close up with a shark and not be worried about it. But I do respect these animals, and I know that they are potentially dangerous. So whenever I go into the water to photograph them, I, you know, have my guard up. I am a little bit apprehensive. But I also know that, you know, they're not nearly as bad as they've been portrayed.
So is it the solitude? Is it the strength of the ocean? Is it the beauty? Is it the risk? What's the thing that has kept you doing this so masterfully for so long?
I mean, I guess to some degree it's all of those things, but I would say it's the sense of discovery. Uh-huh. You know, that the ocean still remains...
The explorer you want to be.
It's still largely unexplored. And as a photographer, it's the perfect place to work. There's no end to the subjects that you can find there, you know?
When you came in, you were talking about the ocean not being in particularly good shape. Mm. Tell us more.
Well, that's true. That is a true statement. I mean, we've got 100 million sharks being killed every year. More than 50% of the coral reefs that once existed in the ocean are gone. They're either seriously degraded or completely gone. We've got ocean acidification. You know, back to the overfishing issue, it's not just sharks. I mean, 90% or somewhere in that vicinity, it's been written, of the big fish in the ocean, the tunas, the sharks, and the billfish have vanished over the last 60 years post-World War II.
Well, how about all right off New England, the bottom fish, absolutely. The cod and
I mean,
that big dispute between the Gloucester fishermen and the NOAA or whatever
It is a serious problem. I mean, I've partnered with the Conservation Law Foundation here in Boston to help bring some visual, you know, acuity to the problem, to show people what's happening out there in New England's oceans. I've dived here my whole life. And when I started diving in the 70s, I used to see big shoals of bait fish, you know, right off the shores in Rockport and Gloucester and those places. And I just don't see that anymore. It's not there. And for that kind of dramatic, you know, loss to have happened in a short amount of time is dramatic.
So it's a combination of overfishing and climate change?
I think, yes, both of those things for sure. You know, I mean, we have gotten very, very good at taking fish out of the ocean. And the reality is today with satellite data and so forth and fishing fleets that have Star Wars, you know, equipment, the fish really don't have a chance. So I think we need more marine protected areas. I think we need more places where the ocean is protected. And we need, you know, obviously wise management. And I think most of the fishermen that I've met would agree with that to some extent, that they think, you know, for their future generations, for their kids to be able to still fish, we need, you know, a sound approach.
Are you optimistic? Bill McKibben was here, who started the whole anti-climate change movement. He was with us last week. He wrote The End of Nature. He's optimistic. It seems to be that kind of person, you know, the 400,000 people in the streets in New York City last September around climate change, mostly on ground. Mm. Is there a movement to save, protect, preserve the place where you work?
There's many movements, and I do feel optimistic, and I do see some real traction, as I mentioned, in that regard. You know, I did a story on the value of marine protected areas for National Geographic in 2007, and at that time, less than 1% of the world's oceans were actually protected. Today, you know, it might be somewhere around 2% or something, which isn't much. And we should be probably up around 30 or 40% if you talk to researchers. But the truth is, there's been somewhat of an arms race with countries protecting huge swaths of ocean, particularly in the Pacific. And I think that sort of momentum will continue. People are seeing, you know, there are countries like Kiribati, a small Pacific island nation, that are already experiencing sea level rise, and they're buying land in other places to move their people. So they are sort of taking the lead on these protections.
Brian, we have less than a minute left. Can you tell me a very quick dolphin interaction story?
Well, I had a magical moment with spinner dolphins actually in Hawaii. I had heard that they play this game called the leaf game, which other dolphins play in other parts of the world with kelp. But they will pick up a leaf that has drifted into the water and pick it up on their pectoral fin or their dorsal fin or their tail and swim with it and then pass it to another dolphin. And I hadn't actually witnessed that. But after weeks of being in Hawaii and making pictures, I went in one morning off a little bay off the beach, not off a boat, early in the morning, and I actually saw three dolphins playing this game and got a picture for the magazine. So it was pretty magical. They allowed me into their world.
That is so
kind of like passing leaf ball or something
exactly.
Like that.
Wow, that is beautiful.
Brian, it's thrilled
to
talk to you.
Thanks
and the pictures
so
are just phenomenal. Where's the outro of this? Here it's
you
right here.
You go to WGBHnews.org
yes,
to see
can.
A lot of the great ones.
Yes, you can. And he's going to be tonight at the New England Aquarium giving a free lecture. What time is the lecture, please?
7 o'clock.
The lecture is at 7, but I've just been told it's sold out. So GBH will be filming it, and we can watch it online.
Terrific.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here, Brian. Coming up, we go inside the ADX Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. It's where Joukhar Tsarnaev could end up if he is given a life sentence. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH.